Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, we're serving up a velvet cushion's worth of cultural gems from the worlds of art, music, and cinema. We'll be starting off by going into the past to find out about a computer program which used AI to create artworks 50 years ago, the first of its kind. Then, with the Oscars just around the corner, we've got an interview with the director and script consultant of one of the movies that's in the running. It's a stunning, albeit heart-wrenching, drama. Finally, we'll hear how one pop star has found her sound by blending the musical influences and the languages of her Arabic and Western heritage. Do stay tuned. That's all ahead here on Monocle on Culture. First up, before the world was flooded with the AI-generated art of Tolkien-esque fantasy landscapes, moody oil paintings of rubbery women with six fingers, and your favourite masterpieces turned into hyper-saturated fashion shoots, there was Aeron, the very first artificial intelligence art programme. A new show at New York's Whitney Museum explores the late artist Harold Cohen, who created the programme decades ago, and asks what, if anything, it can tell us about how to think about this genre of art in the decades to come. Monocle contributor Marissa Masria-Katz has this story from Manhattan.
On the soaring white walls of the Whitney's top floor gallery are dozens of black and white drawings hanging via small magnets. Half the sketches look like petroglyphs chiseled into the walls of an ancient cave. The others are eerie alien-like figures next to still lives of strange houseplants. In the middle of the room is the artist who made it. Well, kind of. That's the sound of Aeron, an artificial intelligence program for art making developed back in the late 1960s by the artist Harold Cohen. The program essentially allows a computer to draw freehand.
Nothing in this AI is pre-canned.
Christiane Paul is the curator of digital art at the Whitney. She put the exhibit together.
In real time and on the fly, this AI system basically does its composition.
On the day I visit the exhibition, an art handler named Max Bell walks me through how the software works.
With the information that the artist has given the machine, it can create hundreds of compositions, or really like a limitless amount of compositions.
After snapping two big pieces of white paper into place, Max clicks a few buttons on a laptop computer. A metal armature swings into action, moving a black Sharpie marker across the page. Shapes are starting to take form. Spiky plants, clay pots, thick random lines. Again, Christiane Paul.
The AI that Cohen works with and develops is early symbolic AI. It is a so-called expert system. And what that means is that everything this AI does is completely encoded in rules. So basically, Cohen created a knowledge base for this AI that basically is shaped around how art represents the world.
Before his work with artificial intelligence, Cohen was an abstract painter, and a successful one at that. He represented Britain in the 1966 Venice Biennale and exhibited in major art world happenings like Documenta and the Carnegie International.
His paintings at the time already looked into systems, and he was very fascinated by exploring systems. Understandably, painting is not necessarily the very best medium to engage with that. And I think that was also what led him to explore computing.
Everything changed when he came to the University of California in San Diego in the late 60s. There, he learned to code, which sets the stage for what comes next.
That is when he starts developing Aeron, or at least the foundation of his art-making program, which is the freehand line algorithm. What was very important to Harold is intentionality in art. He believed that without intentionality, there is no art. So his freehand line algorithm is all about the intentionality of the line. He develops that in the late 60s, and Aaron is basically built on that.
Each room in the exhibit is filled with works Cohen made with his software. There are videos of overlapping leaves and vines in cyan, magenta, and yellow. There are portraits of two women, one black, one white, arms frozen as if caught mid-dance, and one with figures camouflaged by a field of crooked shapes.
He builds Aaron to figure out what an image is. That's his fundamental question.
That's Clement Valla. He's an artist and professor at the Rhode Island School of Design who oversees the school's computation, technology, and culture concentration.
Harold Cohen's interest is really pictures, how pictures are formed, how pictures come into being. And I'd say a predominant amount of contemporary computer art is interested in the computer, the internet, as cultural condition, as site, as context. Harold Cohen doesn't do any of that. He doesn't care about memes. He doesn't care about how computers affect society. He doesn't care about their participation in like the military-industrial complex and analyzing that and taking that apart. He's interested, least up until 2010, he was interested in producing a grammar, a set of procedures that could produce something that would function like a picture does for human culture. And a picture isn't just a set of marks on a two-dimensional surface. A picture is a kind of economy. It's a kind of exchange between an artist and the audience. A picture has intent and meaning. And how do those things come to bear within automated processes?
Today, this feels like a question a lot of people are asking, especially since the emergence of text-to-image generators with algorithms trained on massive datasets like Stable Diffusion and DALL-E exploded into the mainstream these past few years. Again, Christiane Paul.
I don't want to diminish the sophistication of these algorithms, but it is radically different from what Cohen is doing, and I find his Aaron so sophisticated in basically teaching an AI about art making and representation, which is something that current AI tools know nothing about. They don't know anything about composition, or they have no understanding, quote unquote, of the objects in the world. They statistically work on meshing up, optimizing, standardizing massive, massive data sets. So I believe what Cohen has done is an amazing achievement.
The show is up at the Whitney until May 19th. For Monocle, this is Marissa Mazria-Katz.
Thanks, as ever, Marissa. Now, the film Io Capitano follows two Senegalese teenagers as they try to make their way from their homeland to Europe. It's a modern odyssey inspired by the reality of all those who undertake similar journeys and a stirring tribute to the many who don't make it. Director Matteo Garrone, the man behind Gomorrah, Tale of Tales and Pinocchio, tells the story of cousins Seydou and Moussa, and we see the occasionally uplifting, often harrowing journey through their eyes. The frankly astonishing central performance by first-time actor Seydou Sarr is made even more impressive with the knowledge that the film was shot chronologically, the script only revealed to the two main performers on the day of filming. As I mentioned in the introduction, Io Capitano is now up for an Academy Award for Best International Feature Film. I spoke with Matteo Garrone and Mamadou Kwasi, whose personal experience making his own journey from Côte d'Ivoire inspired the film. Here's Mamadou.
For us, and for me, I can say when I use us, because it's not only my story. There are story of many people that was included to this odyssey, this adventure. So, yeah.
Malik Marga?
Yeah.
Salut Bamba. You are Malien from today.
But we are seeing this person.
Only show your passport to checkpoint. Don't talking, only your passport you're going to show.
But when we speak all of there...
There is no problem. You speak only French and show your passport and go without not talking. You are Malian as from today.
Malik Mara.
Malik Mara is your name?
Yeah.
Malian.
Salif Bamba.
Salif Bamba.
Salif Bamba.
Good luck. Malik, you get to Europe, you call me.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Okay.
Next! There is no time to waste. Next!
It's true. As you can see, at the beginning, we see the light for the beginning of the film that we are living in Africa with our family in social living. It's true that we are poor, but we have living in dignity that there is light. By the time that we decide to travel to make this adventure, when we start at the beginning, we don't know that what we are going to face. Traveling through the desert, we hear that it is dangerous. And when you enter, and there you understand that you did a great mistake. So there you are going to see the darkness, how to survive, how to push through the journey, and you will see even dead body on the desert. And you are upset and saying that, why did I make this kind of decision? But it's late and you cannot go back to where you come from. So you have to pursue to continue the journey. And thinking that maybe arriving in Europe will be better. And at the same time, arriving in countries like Libya, the transit country that is not easy for us, you will see people tortured, people that are beaten to die in front of you, lack of money to pay money to those people. So for me, I spent 3 years in Libya surviving, because in Libya it's difficult to use the word to live. And not only me, many people also lost their life in Libya. So for me, when I met Matteo that he was ready to make this movie, I think it was an opportunity to express and give the details what we migrant faced too. Because for what I saw in the desert, I said, okay, maybe this can be a privilege for me to explain details by details, to explain and narrate our story.
Yeah, thanks for telling us how it came about. I mean, there is, and as you said, Mamadou, it was not just your story. It's the story of so many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Matteo, you focus on two young boys, two brilliant, brilliant young actors, I've got to say, playing Sidhu and Moussa, who come from Senegal, come from Dakar, and make their way across Western and then Northern Africa. We start off in a very kind of beautiful, a beatific kind of, there's some good vibes in Dakar, right? These boys, and maybe this was your experience, Mamadou, as well, in the Côte d'Ivoire, that we're not seeing destitution. There's a lot of fun and a lot of culture, and there you are escaping, you are heading towards the sun, maybe, rather than you are escaping something darker, it seems like that.
I start with my cousin from Africa, as you say right now. We decided to leave because my dream was to be a soccer player, because we used to watch European leagues in Africa. We watch everything in television. We support England teams, Chelsea, Manchester United. So you know everything we saw. So we were impressed to have this kind of dream, because we know that Europe gives us more opportunity. And the only alternative that we got, we for youth African boys to travel, is difficult to get visa. So we decided to go by through the desert. Knowing that, we took some information from people saying that how are we going to travel. They give us information, but we did not believe. We are young. We are pushed by our dream to reach anywhere in Europe. So we decided to start the journey. And when we started, we understand that we did a big mistake. And even we did not tell to our parents that we are traveling. We have hidden, running away to reach in Europe, thinking that it will be easy for us. When arriving, we can call, oh, dad, mother, we are in Europe. But we spent 3 years in Libya. So for us, it was a crucial year for us. Very crucial, because before arriving there, even in the desert, we see dead body, as I was saying, people that are frustrated, people that are beaten, tortured from the desert, even till the prison in Libya. So it was the reason why I'm saying that it's a crucial year for us. So we were all survivors, and we today, I think through this movie, I become, through Matteo, the voice of those people that could not afford this journey, because seeing people dying in front of me in the desert, in the prison, and even in the Mediterranean Sea. As you know, in these 10 years, more than 30,000 people died in the Mediterranean Sea. So for us, this movie is a great instrument to inform the whole nation, the whole people, knowing that to understand the real fact that migrant goes through from Africa to Europe. But at the same time, it's not talking about only Africa. It's talking about migrants from all over the world.
As you're alluding to, Mamadou, there are moments of necessarily bleak moments in this film. There are also moments of great beauty in it, and magical beauty in it, Matteo, as well. I love these moments in the desert when Seydou is helping a lady up who's obviously become sick as she's walking through the Sahara, etc., etc. And there are moments that are dotted through the film which are sort of magical, realist moments which are very beautiful indeed. What balance are you trying to strike there between some of the hardships endured by the boys and then these moments of almost surreal but luscious beauty that they see as well?
The moment more oniric, as you said, were necessary for tell what the character, what Seydou, what our hero feel inside. It's a coming of age. So it's a story of a boy that through this journey became a man. And he passed through moment very tough, very traumatic. And we wanted to show to the audience that live the experience of the journey through the eyes of Seydou, how he feel inside. Trauma, wound that will remain forever, you know? And yeah, the story is an archetype. It's the journey of the hero. It's a sort of...
It's an odyssey, isn't it?
Yeah, Homeric fairy tales. I think this journey, this adventure, is probably my most popular movie because it's very accessible, because he's a hero without dark side. I made other movie, always the main character was always anti-hero in a way, with dark side. This time he's completely innocent, you know? You are with him from the beginning and you make the journey through his eyes.
I think it's beautiful because I don't know if you agree with me. It feels like it's a political film that doesn't set out to be a political film. It doesn't set out to make a political point, but nonetheless it is one, necessarily. I don't know what either or both of you think of that, but that's a success to me.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
And that, I guess a lot of that is your viewpoint, where you place the camera, Matteo, is... As you say, you shot this chronologically. The actors, the young actors, didn't know what was going to happen to them each day on set, what the broad story was going to be. And it feels like that you're going from behind them to see what they can see, their horizons, their dawns, their dusks, their happinesses and challenges, rather than we don't see someone in... you know, on the coast of Italy with a pair of binoculars looking at a boat on the horizon, right? We always only ever see it from behind, which is so wonderful. Everything is revealed to the audience at the same time as the boys. Was that your aim, kind of very much a first building block of the film, I wonder?
I would say something more. I made the movie also on the set when we were shooting with the real migrant. You know, all the extra in the movie were real migrants. Mm-hmm. So I would say that often they were co-directing the movie. You know, often I felt that I was the first spectator of the movie. I was not directing them. They recreate something that they lived in the past. And I became a first spectator. And also Seydou and Mustapha, the actor, were like flowing, how do you say, following, you know, what they were happening on with the other, you know. So I think it was very important for all of us to be together trying to recreate this world, you know, and also let the camera became invisible.
And just one last question. The scene that really I found profoundly moving and pivotal, I guess, in the story, especially for Seydou, is when he's taken under the wing, and I think of an older man who I think is the actor Issika Sawagodo, and they're looking for a builder and a builder's mate, builder's laborer, to build a fountain in a rich man's house in the middle of the desert. I understand that's based on your story, isn't it, Mamadou, as well? That specific scene. I mean, that is, for me, the most amazing, moving scene in the film somehow. It's so lovely, the dad that he doesn't have and all the rest of it, perhaps. Tell us what that was like then, and then what that was like to make that such a linchpin scene.
Well, I think that part for me is a salvation, because during the prison, as you can see, we lost even hope to live, because seeing all the scenes that we passed through, and even I say, I prefer to die in the prison, because there was no hope. So I think that man gave me hope to live, to trust, to my dream. He gave me another opportunity to say, now, from now going, I can trust to live again. So this is what he... So it showed the solidarity between I was from Ivory Coast and he was from another country. So this is the value that this film also showed to us and teach to us also, the value of solidarity between us, migrants that are suffering. But we have the same goal, just for to push our dream to get better life. And at the same time, the building that we were doing, I think, that one is a building to pay for our freedom. So this is not a political movie, but an instrument for the politician to understand the real fact, also to change the policy. So this is the answer that I can give. So it's a move of hope. Where there is obstacles, we can think about hope also. And we did it.
Mamadou Kouassi and Matteo Garrone there discussing Il Capitano, which is released in cinemas on Friday, the 5th of April. And finally, the Palestinian-American singer Lana Lubani has found success with her unique sound and use of both Arabic and English in her catchy and ethereal tracks. Fresh from touring with friends of the programme, The Last Dinner Party, Lana joined Monocle on Culture producer Sophie Monaghan-Coombs in the studio to chat about her journey finding her distinctive voice, how she uses music to cope, and what she has planned next.
I have been singing my entire life, and actually I used to sing in a choir and perform with this choir growing up, and I just loved performing. I felt very at home on stage, and while performing with a choir is different to performing by myself, it's still something that feels very native to me. And I think being in this choir has really helped me develop my skills and really figure out that, yes, I do want to do this for a living, and I've always wanted this for my entire life, and I feel like now I'm just learning how to do it properly and professionally, only improving with every single performance. Such a great journey.
You've got quite a unique sound which blends lots of different influences, and it's got a definite, very sort of modern pop energy, but also lots of Middle Eastern influences. How did you sort of arrive at that sound?
Well, I work with one producer. His name is Ben Thompson. We do everything together. He's amazing. And we were making music together, and it was fine, but it was just very normal pop music. And something didn't feel right for me or for my listeners at the time, and my mother. And my entire...
Very important.
Very important, because my mother has always told me to sing in English and Arabic. And it comes from a place of accepting yourself, because I feel like my entire life I didn't like accept my identity, and I had issues with my identity. But the minute I kind of accepted myself in my journey is the moment I decided to put Arabic in my songs. And that's how I kind of segued into the Middle East meets West kind of sound. And I think it's so special because it hasn't really been done before. And I feel like I'm bringing my story as authentically as I can because I can, because it's my story and it's the truth. So I think it's a beautiful thing, and I'm so glad my story kind of developed that way.
I just wanted to pick up on that Arabic and English. How does that work in terms of your songwriting? And does it just come completely naturally, or sometimes are you sort of figuring out which bits work better in one of those languages?
So in the beginning, it was less natural for me, not because I was trying to be someone I'm not, but because I hadn't really written in Arabic and I felt like my vocabulary wasn't good enough. I wasn't confident in my Arabic songwriting. But something I did tell myself was I'm going to write in my dialect, because Arabic has so many different dialects, and I never heard my specific, very specific dialect being sung in on the radio or anything in popular songs. So I never thought it was possible to do that. So I kind of struggled with writing, but I powered through and I did it. And that's when I wrote my song, The Snake. And that's the song that started everything. But the more that I've been writing, the easier it's been getting. And honestly, like now, it just comes very naturally to me. And I feel like I don't really have to think about what language I'm writing in. I just write whatever I'm feeling. And sometimes it comes out in Arabic, sometimes it comes out in English. And just, it makes sense to me. I can't really explain it.
And it sounds very natural. As someone who doesn't speak any Arabic, when you kind of switch, it's not jarring at all.
It's the way that I speak, actually, at home. Like, I speak English and Arabic at home, and I switch between the languages, and actually I don't really notice what language I'm speaking in or thinking in, even. It's just natural to me.
I am angry, I am weak, something's up and yours to keep, like a moment on your cheek, wish I could kiss you better, voices blowing in the breeze, so much more than I perceived. Now it's getting hard to breathe. Wish I could make it better.
I wanted to talk specifically about Make It Better. I imagine the past few months and carrying on has been very difficult. It's a really beautiful song. It's very personal, and the visuals for it particularly are so beautiful. And I wonder, during this time, which must be really hard, particularly for you, what music has kind of given you and how it's played a role as a way of coping, I guess.
Music is everything to me, and I feel like music is my way of dealing with the world and my emotions. I write songs whenever I'm feeling sad or emotional or mad. Any type of emotion is valid. But yeah, I feel like I know how to articulate myself best with music, through music, rather than by speaking, for example. So with Make It Better, I walked into the studio, the home studio that we work out of, and I found Ben, my collaborator, on the floor playing a very beautiful but melancholic sounding guitar chord progression. And it just came to me in a way, and my emotions poured out of me. And it wasn't everything I was feeling, but it was definitely part of what I was feeling. And I kind of just felt the melodies come out of me without having to think about it. And it was a very beautiful but sad moment.
And it is a beautiful song, and it captures so much.
Thank you.
Just finally, I wanted to ask you, what's next? You've had so much recent success, and I imagine there's a lot of pressure, but also a lot of excitement about what you're going to do next. What are some of your plans and the things you're excited about?
So I've just released a song called Stanna. It's different to my other stuff. It feels more confident, and it's a different side of me. And I'm excited that people get to hear that now. And I announced my first ever headline show in London on March 27th, which I'm so excited for. It's going to be so great, and I'm prepping for it at the moment. And there's going to be so much more music coming out this year.
Amazing. Well, best of luck with all of it, and thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's your health, I'm your healer. Here's your tongue, I'm your speaker. Diving into
And that is all for this week. My thanks to Lana Lubani there, as well as Mamadou Kwasi and Matteo Garoni and Marissa Masria-Katz. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. Thank you also to Lily Austin for help editing this week's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.